Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Laura Checkley.
And I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And we are of course here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't, who the bloody hell will? I'm being reserved this week.
First time for everything. As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. On that note, who are we celebrating this week, Laura?
Well, it's fair to say that this week's guest is bossing this industry. Now, when I say he does it all, I mean he does it all and then some. He is an award-winning actor, writer, director, as well as a CEO and founder of the Triforce Creative Network, which is an organisation that promotes equal opportunities in the entertainment industry.
I literally cannot wait to talk to him about that. This week's guest has been a regular on our TV screens for decades now. You may remember him in shows such as The Smoking Room, Coronation Street, London's Burning, The Vice, Midsummer Murders, BBC America's Undercover and NBC's International Ministries AD, to name but a few.
He has made it onto the big screen too, starring in movies Intimacy, Revenge's Tragedy and the cult hit Adulthood.
Not content with all that, he directs and writes too. Show off. His directorial debut, Ambition to Live, saw him receive the Audience's Choice Awards at the London Film Network. As for his writing, well, that's not going too bad either. He's written on many BBC dramas and most notably a writer on Idris Elba's hit show In the Long Run for Sky.
In 2016, he was co-creator of ITV's Sorry, I Didn't Know, an all-inclusive comedy panel show focusing on Black history, which has had so far 3 series to date and has just been nominated for an RTS award. Nice. And not stopping there, in 2018, he co-founded Dandy, an industry-facing one-stop service that delivers diverse and inclusive talent directly to production companies, broadcasters and content creators. Geez, I mean, I would ask him when he finds time to sleep, but I just read somewhere that he teaches yoga and meditation, so I think his sleep is just fine. Although I've just heard he's had a baby, so let's not talk about sleep.
Maybe not. Before we finally introduce him to you, let us read a little something he said that really resonated with me and Law. Inclusion and access aren't merely political aims. They should be the cornerstones of not only our creative industry, but core to our societal responsibility. If you include everybody, you don't need to exclude anyone. Listeners, please give a very warm Proper Class Podcast welcome to the incredible trailblazer that is slightly tired new dad, Fraser Ayres.
Wow, what an intro. What an intro.
What a marathon. We always like to give marathon intros because this is mostly about what you've achieved, and obviously we'll talk about how you got there, but I know we've got like a, but my partner said to me today, I was reading an intro, I said, does this sound all right? She was like, yeah, it's just, it's quite long. I was like, yeah, of course, you have to celebrate everything you've done.
Oh, you know what I mean? Thank you. You know, only half of it's real, so it's all good.
Isn't that what Wikipedia is for?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be real, does it?
In yourself and to be someone else, it's fine.
It just feels like you've had or have so many lives and so many strings to your bow. Like, seriously, I do mean that. Like, when do you have time to do, well, now you're going to be a dad. I mean, you just got loads of people working for you now and just delegate.
Well, we do have a team at Triforce now, which is great, you know, on the production company side, as well as on the Dandy side, which is really, really good. But, yeah, being a new dad is a wonderful, wonderful challenge. It's like the last 40 years didn't matter.
Yes.
Like everything you were, everything you believed in, everything you like, it just, oh, you were playing. Oh, good for you, you were playing. Now it begins. And it's a beautiful journey. It's a beautiful journey.
Wow. And how old is Bubs?
So he's 4 months old, and aww, him and mum are doing really, really well.
So new babies, but let's go back to like the first question that we always start with every week is asking our guest to take us back to somewhere, a time, a place that reminds them of their working class past. So if you could take me and Laura somewhere, where, and our listeners, where would you take us?
Okie dokie. So I'm going to take you back to the Beaumont Lees estate in Leicester. And at the back of the courtyard on Linney Road, in the block of flats, there's a ground floor, two-bedroom flat. And that's where I grew up with my mom. And, you know, as soon as, it's funny, isn't it? It's like, we all know, but, you know, you've got some listeners who don't know. And it's like, as soon as you say estate, it's like they're just seeing like hurricanes and bins everywhere. And, you know what I mean? And it's like, some days, but not all days. And I wanted to talk about this place. That's where I grew up. My mum raised me in that flat. And the reason I wanted to go there is kind of take you through the door, and it's not what you think it is. What my mum did was, like, you go into the little tiny little hallway, and before you go into the lounge, she's made a curved archway. She plastered it herself and repainted it in the flat. And then you go through into the lounge, and she hand-built a red brick fireplace with a huge timber beam in it. This is in a flat. Not probably to stay. And my mum always, aspiration was a big thing. And so when I was 7, I told my mum I wanted to be an actor. Single parent, no money, you know, Bartley's estate. And my mum was like, all right then, cool. We didn't know anyone. We didn't have any access. And, you know, that's a whole story how that all happened.
Yeah.
But my mum didn't care. She was like, look, if you do what you love, then you'll never work a day in your life, that kind of motto. And she made our house a little palace. And it wasn't scummy and poor, and because the love that she poured into that place. And it's quite funny when I was thinking about the audio experience of your show, and you know, as soon as you use certain words and they like trigger us in particular directions, and I was like, no, I really want to talk about the aspiration and that graft, without a doubt, the graft, and you know, the markets that she did for us. She'd get like a teapot. So this is the story of how I got to where I am at the beginning. Okay, so she'd put me in a pram, and she would walk 5 miles because she couldn't afford the bus. And we would go to a car boot, and she would buy like cutlery and teapots, 20p, 30p. We'd come back with a box on my pram, go back home, and that week she would clean them and silver dips and wash them and do all that. And the following week, we would take that box with all the cleaned and good stuff, and she would turn 20p into 40p. Yeah. She'd turn a quid to 2 quid. And we did that and that for years. And then she got a market stall. We did the same thing. And she literally went up and up and up. And all of that hard work basically went into me getting to London.
That's incredible.
She was from Scotland, and that big heart of aspiration and that big heart of constantly like growing and evolving was in her, and it was really embodied in that little flat. And so even though it was just us, we had a sign in the toilet. It was like, no matter how big or small it is, a family together means home. Mm. And so Christmas is like, so she'd buy the things from Car Boots, like Lego, and rewrap them or get things from Car Boots. And so Christmas, I had loads of presents that she would save. Well, I also found out later on that, you know, the way she paid for that is by going without food. But, you know, let's be positive. you know, working class.
Which was often the case, though, wasn't it? It was often the case, go without food. And
yeah, man, you got a kid there, and, you know, you don't ever want, I feel this now, but you don't ever want them to feel like they're going without. And, you know, with that circumstance, you meld it, you manipulate it, you make it buckle under those circumstances until it works. And so, yeah, the place is that flat.
When I hear you talking about that and the aspiration and stuff, it's I just find it, you know, as I'm sure you know, being working class, that a lot of people will hear council estate immediately and think, oh, crikey, how bleak, how awful. But actually inside all those little places and those flats are people working not just really hard, but they have dreams. Mm-hmm. And you know, like your mum's story feels like, I thought you were going to turn around and say she was suddenly someone like, you know, like Lord Sugar, who's like turned, you know, like suddenly in the markets and then like worked way up. But there's something about that. Like my stepdad did the same. We had a little flat and he did it up and he ended up, you know, creating businesses, many lives and moving and shifting with the times all the time and created a life for us. And we felt like we never went without until obviously you see someone with, you know, you start bumping into posh people and you go, oh, right, yeah, you know. But it's so, I really want to talk about the aspiration stuff because we do, not just us actors, but, you know, like people that want to do things and want to be things. And like our mums that didn't get a go at that. Like your mum was probably, she probably could have been a kick-ass businesswoman, right, given the opportunity and the...
This is the thing. I mean, what she managed to build, you know, we had, you know, so she, we did that. And this was the thing about the flat as well. It was a flat on an estate, but we managed to get an exchange to a middle-class area.
Wow. Yes,
because it was so dope that those middle class people went, I don't care about living on the estate, this is an amazing flat, and they moved. And then it was quite interesting because there was more violence and more problems in that middle class place than there was the working class place. Mm-hmm. And that community that comes together in working class places, everyone knows where they are in that pecking order and how things are and how things run and who you can lean on for sugar and, you know, can you hold the baby for 5 minutes, like, you know what that is. When we're on the estate and when we're in that environment, like, we want more, we work for more, but there is an understanding of circumstance. Mm. And then the higher up you got the chain. So when I went to that kind of middle class place, people wanted fights. People wanted me to join their gang because I was from Beaumont Lees. And you're like, why are you lot fighting? Like, there's no need for that. There's no need. Now I am in this very, you know, affluent place in Nottingham. The complaints I hear from neighbours or the local community, and now this place is ridiculous. It's like Jake Bugg's got a place here. Do you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't even need it. It's like, it's ridiculous, this place. And the complaints that come from people, like, I think I've landed, and I'm like, oh my God, a green tree. Oh my God, I'm so happy to be here. And they really don't understand how fortunate they are in terms of that gap. And they don't see it. And I think it gets worse the higher up the class chain you get, that privilege kind of just blinds your ass.
Yeah.
You talk about moving to like a middle class area as a kid. Did that mean you moved schools as well?
Moved school.
And how was that? How was school? Like, how was moving school? And
it was definitely different and interesting. And again, you know, on the estate, there was people who looked like me. Like, we're the first generation of mixed race kids. Like, there was a bunch of us. And then you go to this kind of middle class place and there's not so many. And it was quite interesting that there were real problems with racism on the Beaumont Lees estate back in the 80s, without a doubt. I experienced it. My mum experienced it. Bless, it was there. But again, when you go to that middle class place, it's almost like there's enough capacity to be a real dick about it.
Yeah, right.
It's like when you're broke, you haven't got a lot of time to really do a lot of stuff about how you hate brown people. Do you know what I mean? You haven't got a lot of time on your hands. Whereas when you're middle class, you can be more leisured about it and, you know, afford the Daily Mail and stuff and that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so when we moved, it was really, really different. And I found the people really different. Even being very, very young. And it took me, I never adjusted.
Mm.
And funny enough, it's something that I've encountered, you know, like in our industry. I remember when I first came to our industry and my agent, she was amazing. But she was like, you need to get rid of that accent. That's the first thing off, mate. Get rid of that. That's not going to work. You need to just deaden that. I think privilege is a real pain in the bum. I think privilege really gets in the way of an awful lot of these issues all the way through. Do you know what I mean? And it permeates everything, and those kind of decisions and who gets hired and who doesn't and who's in fad and who isn't. And unfortunately, that's something that still exists, and it exists on the estate level, or it exists on the, you know, your home level, but it exists kind of in your industry as well. And I think that for me, when you look at the things that my mum put in me, like look after each other, empathy, kindness, those things that aren't about be a better businessman, have more acumen, those kind of things. Again, as you kind of come across people who have a little bit more capacity for a little bit more beyond survival, they kind of squander it.
Yeah.
And so the things that are important to them are making more money or being more famous rather than enjoying life, so to speak. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think never settled outside of Beaumont Leys ever again. And that's why I'm bloody chippy.
So how old, when you went over to that new school, how old were you?
11.
And do you feel like, looking back, that did it give you a good education? Were you academic? Did you feel like you thrived more there than if you'd have stayed back in the old place?
No, because it was a bit of a dive.
Right.
It was a bit of a dive in itself. And actually, the education side of me was always kind of self-driven, outside of the kind of schools that I went to. But that place then gave me access to a grammar school.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Ooh, and this is back in the day of catchment. You know, and I know that stuff still applies, but like that was a big thing, a grammar school. And then you get there and it's just another dive.
Yeah, right.
Oh, hang on, my mum's done all this work and it's a pit. But you know, we had access to the grammar school in that place from Blaby, where we were. And so, again, that enabled me to kind of dive right into my GCSEs and pursue this path to initially going to drama school. But been that idea when my mum got ill, she got quite sick. And I was like, I'm not going to London while you're poorly. Sod that. It's not going to happen. So that was, it gave us access to that better education, the things on paper that people will recognize that enable you to change those circumstances, you know. And then, so we did that, got the grammar school, got the grades, went to college, and then I quit 3 months before my exams. I had a predicted A and two Bs. I was going to kill it. But I realized 3 months before the end, I was wasting my time.
And what did you feel like you were wasting your time just on academia? Were you like, why am I doing these? Like, what? I'm just delaying doing what I really want to do.
Yeah, I'd had the great fortune of doing a film in the middle of that education in the summer. And it became rapidly apparent that this theoretical exploration of acting was zero to do with the practical application of it.
Right.
So I went to my tutors, and I had amazing tutors. I had Melissa Sands, who was one of the co-founders of Rambert. She was teaching at Martin Mobley.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, she was there at the beginning. You had Sally, who set up Trestle Theatre Company, you know, the Mass.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God, I love Trestle. Were dope,
you know. and Melton Mowbray had recently, the college had got some money from the lottery, and we had a proper theatre and a sprung floor.
Wow.
Yeah, it was big things, and that was the place. If you're into acting, like, but that was a four-hour journey from where I lived to there and back. Like buses into town, buses out to the, you know, having to do all that.
And was this like a free, it wasn't fee paying or anything like that? It was education.
But you had to travel to get to that school, do you know what I mean? And then they did auditions.
You needed money for that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and that's where the market, you know, supported that. So we'd work markets at the weekend and we'd go and do all that in car boots and then go and do the school during the week, do the journey, spin it round. And it was quite a thing when, so I went to my tutors and I was like, I think I'm wasting my time. And they went, you are.
Wow.
Because they were all like real practitioners. Like, look, there's like, we love you. You love us. It's all good. And oh my God. And they were like, we're going to write incredible things in your record of achievement. Now, I don't know if all your listeners know about the Red Book, the Record of Achievement. This was
come on.
This was the thing, man. Like, you could squat. But as long as it didn't make it into that red book, like, you could be prime minister. It didn't mean anything. And so I told them, and then I went back and told my mum. And my mum, we had this thing called devil's advocate, which is if I was like, black is black, she'd be like, no, black is white. And we would just go back and forth and work it out until we get to the truth. And so I said to her, I think I need to leave. She's like, we're 3 months off this thing that's been in play for 7 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. And we did devil's advocate. And then she said back to me, we're going to sort this out tomorrow and you're going to leave. Like, even those 3 months is a waste of time. Let's not do that.
Wow.
Yeah, she was amazing. She was amazing.
Wow, that is amazing.
And how did you end up doing that film? How did that film come to pass that you'd done in the summer?
Well, I guess this is, kind of bang on what we're talking about. So back in the day, there used to be pretty much every theatre in the country had a youth group.
Right.
Yeah. Every school, pretty much. And what it meant was that anybody from anywhere in those areas could have access to that.
Yeah.
It might be hard for them to find out it even exists. And I didn't know. It was a teacher who was like, we want you to apply for this. But anybody could have a shot at that. And then they could go and be in the theatre and be with kids from all different areas and that kind of thing. And I joined the Leicester Haymarket youth theatre.
Oh, sure.
When I was like 10, 11, really, really young. We did a play. It did very well. And at the time, there was a thing called the Lloyds Bank Challenge, which was all the young plays across the country. And then the best ones would get picked and get to perform on the Olivier. So there's me, Beaumont Lee's boy, on the Olivier, chatting with Ian McKellen, 11 years old. Like,
oh, that's amazing. And did you have any idea of the gravitas of that? Were you just like bowling up to this theatre going, oh, this is cool?
No, I wanted to be an actor. I actually had Ian McKellen's Hamlet poster, like, as 11 with Hamlet on my team, I this was my absolute dream, like just unfolding, live, so to speak, at a very young age. So we did that play, and then the director did another play that was a professional play in London, and she cast me in that. And from that agent at the age of, I was 12 at that point. And so that's how I then had an agent who, she really, really looked after me and supported me. And she was like, I don't want to burn you out. We want to make those steps. And so she did. And I got that film, Speak Like a Child, when I was 15.
Wow.
And before that, I'd done a little The London's Burning and then a little bit of The Bill, while doing my education,
Amazing.
So again, I was really fortunate to have people around me that, or introduced to people that were like, I've got you. It's okay. I see what you're trying to do here.
Did those like early experiences, because that's, we talk about this so much, like I think our guests have been, we're so lucky, they've been so diverse in the areas that they come from, the areas that they now work in. And but I'd say that like access and financial access to start, being able to start your career, or I say access, I think that's probably the opposite of what I mean, really, like financial barriers really. Do you think a lot of, because you've done so much to address that, do you feel like those early experiences of your own, like, have stayed with you, and as soon as you were able to do something about it, you have?
That's literally where Triforce came from. I had a bit of a voice, and I was like, actually, I think I know what the problems are, and therefore I think I can find the solutions to these problems. And so that's literally what it was. Like I said, that chippiness that comes through.
Chippiness, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to build an organisation that's just chippy, and we're just going to do chippy stuff for a couple of decades. That's it. So absolutely that informed that. And it's quite interesting as well, because, talk about the 80s, and again, some of your listeners will be like, yeah, bleak times. But there was actually more opportunity in the 80s. Like me and my wife were joking about this. She was like, you're the Tory wet dream. It's like, what? Oh no, shit, I am literally the Tory wet dream. Oh no, this is awful. And when I look at the 80s, that theatre that had a bit of funding behind it that could do things, right, and all of that access, like, that was gone in the 90s. And so again, when we set up Triforce and we created the Monologue Slam, which is around the country and getting actors doing that whole thing.
Nice, amazing.
When you were doing that, like, we were doing that because the theatres didn't have those access points. They didn't have those pathways. So in some ways, you know, there was kind of more access. Like, I don't think I could get through now. Like, if I was, like, yeah, you know, yeah. I'm glad my son is upper middle class now, because I did, like, if he was me, mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really not sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went to drama school, like, it was under a Labour government, and I can't tell you how many people were on scholarships, like working class. And it was like, it was just like, wow. I mean, because I'd never, ever have been able to go to drama school, like, forget it. My mum was like, you need to get a scholarship. Yeah. So it always felt really like, you know, just felt like this is never going to happen, but I'll give it a go. And luckily, under a Labour government, then I went. But, you know, forget it now. I wouldn't have I wouldn't even gone for an audition for it. I mean, now to audition for a drama school, I mean, you're talking, what is it, Han, these days? 60, 70 quid, something like that?
I don't know, but it's enough. And then, you know, if you're not in London, that's like such a London-centric thing as well. Yeah. You know, obviously, if you're living in... Well, anywhere outside of London, once you've got to get on a train that they're extortionate and you've got to maybe stay over. And
you interested in eating that day? What about some food that day? Like,
yeah.
Good luck with that.
Even stuff like, if you think about, like, particularly musical theatre, which I direct quite a lot of, but if you look at musical theatre, like, there's such a massive, massive, like, how many young working class people get to practice a song with a pianist?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that, there are so many different examples of where there is inequality of access. Like that is such a privilege. Like to understand what sheet music is, to have somebody who's taught you how to read it. I mean, I've been directing musicals for 20 years now. I can't read sheet music. I can't read music. No one ever taught me to read music.
I did 3 years worth of training and still can't read music.
I mean, that's just shameful. But. But do you know what I mean? And in all seriousness, I see young people all the time. I was doing some auditions for the National Youth Music Theatre. And, you know, it's a fantastic thing. But when I first went, as a grown woman, like, as a director, I've been directing a long time and was there, and I was like, this is a school? Do you know what I mean? This is a school. This is where people go to school. I couldn't believe it. But also, there was, like, a young guy who came, and he was a young black kid from East London, and he said, I don't really know much about musicals. I just really like them, and I'd like to do some. He was in this room and he like got up to sing, and I could see him watching. I could see his confidence, his love, his everything draining from his body, watching people get up with sheet music taped the right way, knowing what they were doing. And he had some lyrics written on a bit of A4. And I just kept him behind afterwards. And I said, listen, I'm a woman in my 40s and I feel out of place here. You are not worse than those people. You just haven't had the same access. It doesn't make you worse. Yeah. In fact, it makes you... chippy is my favourite word, so I appreciate your use of it. It makes you chippier. It makes you more... You've got here. You've turned up. You've found out about this. You've written those lyrics out yourself. And even though you know at the moment they're better than you, you still did up and did your thing.
One of the things we talk about with Triforce and Dandy is equality and equity. The difference between those two things, do you know what I mean? We want equality, the device is equity. And when you have these kind of Tory bods going, well, I did it. Oh. And you go, yeah, but your starting position was like a mile ahead. And every 5 minutes you stop for a tasty orange.
Yeah, right.
And that like access really is an issue. And that's what, you know, that's what we literally, what we try to do, Triforce. And we try and give as much time. We get a CV in from someone and it doesn't look right, we will contact them. And we now have 26,000 people on our internal network.
That's so amazing.
So that's a lot of people. But we've got the people to go, hi, listen, I've seen your CV. Let me just go through that with you. You put these things at the top. You do this. Don't do it in Comic Sans.
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of thing. Because no one has ever taken that time.
Yeah, and if you don't know, you don't know. And that's it.
You don't know what you don't know.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's go back to you. So presumably that then all led on to you. You were talking about drama school. And so I guess all these wonderful teachers around you were going, oh, try here, try there. Did you go to drama school?
No, yeah, I didn't. That was where my mum took poorly. And so I had, you know, we were doing the scholarship.
You were going to, your plan was to. Yeah. And then you're right.
And then mum got ill and it was like, I just don't want to be away from her. Do you know what I mean? I'm not about that. So we kind of rejigged things a little bit. And then we basically worked really hard to kind of get us both down. My mum was so fatalistic, but she would call it realistic. Do you know what I mean? She's like, well, we know I'm going to die soon, so let's get you down to London. Do you know what I mean?
Oh my God, bloody hell.
Council house, and that'll transfer to you, so we need to get you down there. And that was, like, she was pragmatic. And, you know, and then she lived for another, you know, 20-odd years, God bless her. But she then kind of moved us down to London via Southend into London. And then when she got really, really poorly and I was much older and I was making a bit of money then, I was like, do you know what? This is my turn now. And I said, we're leaving London. And she refused. She was like, no, this has literally been the whole thing for 20-odd years. Like, no. And I went, it's not worth it. Like, London's a horrible place to be poorly, particularly terminally ill. Mm. And it can be very lonely and isolating. And I was like, no. So the compromise was if we could find somewhere that we could commute. And so we ended up in Colchester, which was like 45 minutes to Liverpool Street.
Right, okay, yeah.
So we exchanged to there and we ended up in Colchester for the kind of the remainder 8 years of her life and stuff. And again, it was that negotiation with her because she was very clear on what she was doing for me and support her. And without her, none of it would have happened. And so in terms of access, she may not have known, you know, famous actors or had the money for university, but she always, with what she had, provided as much access as she could.
Tell our listeners a bit about Triforce and how that all started and why that started. I know, obviously, because you feel passionate, but when did all that come about?
That kind of started, its kind of main seed was like 2003. So I'd been acting, you know, off and on since I was like 12 from that point and doing different bits, doing movies, doing bits of TV and stuff. And I was doing a play in Edinburgh. And for your listeners who don't know about Edinburgh, like, it's just where everyone goes in August. It's just like a whole industry gravitates to Edinburgh and just sees shows, chats, gets very, very drunk. And
Paul.
If
you've ever produced a show there, Paul.
So we were in Edinburgh 2003 doing a play called The People Next Door. And I was there with my fellow actor, Jimmy Akambola. And this was the days before The Underbelly and before kind of everything had like Spiegel tents and ting. And basically, like, it was all kind of disparate and everywhere all over Edinburgh. And we managed to get like half of Edinburgh inside this really nasty club called The Establishment. But The Establishment plays hip hop, and we packed it out. It was crazy. And I was there with Jimmy, and we just looked at this vibe and this love and this joy. And we were just like, this doesn't exist in London.
Mm.
And we realized that when you go to Edinburgh, everyone's like, hey, what are you doing? Let me come and see your show. This is what I'm doing. And there was this kind of collaboration, and there's kind of like a leveling of creatives in a sense.
Yeah.
Which in London, the first question is like, who's your agent? Are you working? Are you good? Like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
We were like, what happens if we could take this to London, where actors felt safe, actors from all walks of life felt safe together? And what if we got a whole bunch of directors and casting directors really pissed? What would happen? And that was the beginning of Triforce.
That is literally the best business plan I have ever heard.
No, your business model, Fraser. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, it involves lots of alcohol. And it broke privilege. So we had like top tier casting directors coming, getting drunk and, you know, cards on the table. Those kind of people get scared around working class people, black people, female people, disabled people. Like they just get uncomfortable, particularly en masse.
Yeah.
So it was like, let's get you drunk, have a good night. And these people would come, rave it up. And one of our big stories from them was, do you remember The Scorpion King? Like it was the offshoot from The Mummy. It was the thing that
all right,
all
yeah,
that
yeah.
stuff. So The Scorpion King was happening. We had the casting director. He came and had an amazing time. And then six people got auditions on Monday who didn't even have agents.
Wow.
And three of them ended up in the film. And it just broke those barriers. They just had a good time. And, oh, God, yes. I'm not awkward around you because, well, and over the years, it just broke down and broke down and broke down. And we did that with the readings at Soho Theatre and kept that ethos behind it. And then we did Monologue Slam and, again, kept that ethos of casting directors and actors. And, again, it was finding a solution to that problem of privilege and the distancing that that privilege creates.
How do you find being a working class actor and stepping, in what feels like quite a middle class sort of surrounding? So like if you go to the National or wherever you went, have you ever had imposter syndrome?
I mean, literally every day. Mm. That is something. And it's something that I mentor a lot of people trying through that as well, because it's actually really toxic. You know, like things like guilt. Like guilt is not a productive emotion. It does not help you in any way. It can point you in a direction, and once it's pointed, there's no point holding guilt. Like, you need to move that. And it's same as that imposter thing. It's actually not productive, and it's quite toxic. And it knocks on to so many things, you know, self-selection, self-sabotage, you know, you're always late for things, you're not going up for things. You know? We actually do a lot of research around people who apply for jobs. And so, like, we will open up a pathway, a scheme, and there's really fascinating stuff. Like, so if you open up a program, okay, and we're like, we want writers, and we're going to open up this window for writers to come in, like we do with Writer Slam. So you do it, and in the first week, it's all middle-class white men.
Mm.
It's all you get. Because they're the ones who are like, God damn it, you've been lucky to have it.
Yeah, and they've got the confidence to go, you want to hear
this. This is excellent. So you get that in the first week, and then you get kind of like it merges in the middle bit. But then towards the end, that's when you get working class people in a flurry. That's when you, interestingly, if you're looking at then gender, that's when all the women.
God, that's mad.
That is fascinating.
And there's actually a lot of research been done about men and women applying for jobs. So when there's a job description, men need like 30% of it. To go, yeah, man, I'm apply for that. It'd be cool. I can do that shit. Women need like 86% minimum. Yeah,
for sure.
Before they leave and look, oh, that's not for me. Like, and so again, you've got that kind of, and that's self-selection, imposter syndrome, you know, from the gender
it's
aspect.
So interesting.
But those things end up really impacting our behaviours and, you know, our own abilities for success. A little bit, and it is that imposter, and it is something I have fought and fought and fought. I'm actually just like flashing back to like even recent things where I'm like, I've questioned whether I should be there. And then what ends up happening with me, and it's not perfect, And welcome to the psychology session. It's not perfect, but I end up then overcompensating and being like ultra like on top of that.
Do you know what I mean?
I can't just go in normal like Dave. I have to go in like up here. Do you know what I mean?
I admire that so much. Like I'll be on set, you know, and I'll watch a white male, straight male stand and hold court really confidently. I think I'm pretty confident, but I'm not an academic, never have been. I was terrible at school. Possible, though self-diagnosed, impossible dyslexia, all of that going on. So when I'm surrounded by, you know, those sort of very theatrical actors that well-read and obviously Oxbridge, Cambridge, those sort of kind of backgrounds, I shrink massively. Mm-hmm. Still, at 43, even when I could just go, do you know what, walk away, Laurie, you don't want to sit and talk to them people anyway. But often I will sit there and just completely shrink and shrivel because I think I have nothing interesting to say. When I do talk, some people take me piss out my accent. They think it's funny. Or they think it's, I don't know, endearing. But I don't know. So I don't think people are doing it to be mean often. They just go, all right, Laura.
It's their biases.
Yeah, yeah. And then obviously, you know, I'm queer. So I've got all of that. I've always had all of that going on. But I think, come on, Laura, you're 43. You've got interesting things to say. It's your fucking, don't matter they ain't read that book. I'm not going to talk about something else. And I just sit there and what I do is I'll go on my phone or like, and that's still at 43. So when you're thinking about youngsters that are, you know, trying to put themselves forward for anything this day and age, and they ain't got any money, they haven't really done well at school, you think, how are they even going to get through an application where they initially see that it might cost them 60 quid to audition? How do they even know what drama school is? How do they? And it's all about going back to that, the beginnings of careers and beginnings of how you get into this industry. And I just think it's amazing what you're doing because a lot of people in your position don't.
So do I.
You know, and I think it's, I just think it's just so incredible. And yeah, I think they're very lucky to have that access. And I really want people to know because, you know, I didn't know half the stuff that you were doing. And I just really hope that there are more youngsters out there that will just figure out that there's someone like you and you're and with Dandy and everything, that there is access and there's a possibility. It just feels really hopeful and wonderful.
Well, we recently hired an outreach person for Dandy as well, and so now we're actually going into the schools.
Yes, I was going to say, have you been into schools? Brilliant.
Like we operate, you know, at all levels, but we also handle the entry point. And you go, well, that's the point where you've already been to school and had the, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a director. You've already had that.
Yeah, right.
And that's the thing we're talking about that's completely missing. So we're like, actually, we need to go back to school and we're going to like GCSE level, that like, actually, we're going to that level. So then the thoughts can emerge that you can then do that. Because unless you go back far enough, it just, it don't work.
It's sort of too late, isn't it? And marks are made and you feel like your path's made.
Yeah, exactly.
Because other than that, it's luck, right? Other than that, it is luck that you get a teacher that went to Ron Bear and knows where she should be sending you. Other than that, it is just luck. Everything for me was luck. And then on top of that, wonderful parents that support and put everything into hours, money that they didn't have.
Yeah, right.
And it's an ongoing thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you were like, I'm sure like we might all feel like this, but I sway between feeling extremely optimistic about how the industry, the kind of arts are changing and becoming more inclusive, and deeply depressed about the fact that it feels like we're back in the 80s. Mm. And I sort of switch back and forth on an hourly basis. If, obviously, you're watching this all the time and you're working this. Like, how do you feel? Do you think things are getting better? Do you think people are like looking at diversity in all its widest forms and like there are more access points, or do you still look at it and think this is a huge mountain that we're just at the bottom of?
It's actually a completely different conversation post COVID and post, unfortunately, George Floyd.
Yeah.
Like drum that we banged for 15 years. And people, so what we do is we go, okay, look, that people come to us and go, can you get us a black writer for this? Or can we get these actors from one? Absolutely. Can you support us so we can continue to find Dwayne in Birmingham?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Ooh, and it's all around the soft arts of, ooh, those incidents happened and literally our door, people have been banging down our door. But this is also a kind of interesting division. We had to divide up between the arts world and kind of the TV and film world, because actually they're completely different worlds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And back in my day, you know, you go through the theatre, you cut your teeth, you get an audition for the bill. Like,
yeah,
that's not really the way anymore in terms of what theatres have become, and quite closed off to their local communities and the kind of things that they're showing.
100%.
So that kind of route of access into that TV world, it's not really that way anymore. And then the arts world itself, we found it to be, like, we never, over all the work that we've ever done, we have never, ever, ever, and we have tried, we have never been supported by the Arts Council.
What?
Literally not once.
I find that mind-blowing.
That's for my part two podcast, but we were never supported by them, no matter how hard we tried. But the receptivity that we're getting now is from the TV and film world. Mm-hmm. And it's not from the arts world. It's from that world. And so it looks like one industry, but actually they are two pocket industries. And where the TV and film industry have kind of gone, oh, we really need to sort this out. Don't get me wrong. They're sorting it out, car money.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
They're like, no one's got a soul. No one's got a soul. it's the money and the kind of impetus from the Americans coming as to what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But what's kind of happened with the arts world is that an awful lot of those very, very posh boys and girls who are running the theatres, now there's no money in it. And they're leaving in droves. And artistic directors are not the ones pre-COVID. And the kind of, you know, stage awards game they all play about the arts and, you know, all that kind of thing. The game stopped and it became not very fun for a lot of these people. And they've kind of gone, oh, well, I'll go and do that other thing I was going to do. And they're doing that. That leaves a gap for us. And it's interesting when you see hires like the hiring of Lorne Campbell at the National Theatre of Wales. He makes Corbyn look right wing, Lorne Campbell does, man. Like, he's red, red, red. And you see that National Theatre of Wales hiring that kind of artistic director for their organisation. And his things like local community, everything Wales, black people, disabled people. And you see that. That's the kind of change that the arts world really, really needs. And I think, hopefully, fingers crossed, is going through. Because even the shareholders of these buildings and the committees, they understand that unless they repurpose their buildings simply cannot exist.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting. And that's where the arts world can start to catch up in that space as we're making more and more appointments of more and more interesting people that aren't just handpicked by the Arts Council. Yeah.
Well, I hope you're right. I really do. Will you try to instill some working class values into, is it her or he?
Him? It's he, Elliot. He. Oh, Elliot. Yeah, we've been talking about this. Like, I had a conversation with a friend of mine and he was like, but he doesn't need to have your baggage.
No, that's true.
Like, he doesn't need to have your, like, that imposter thing. Like, he doesn't need to have, he doesn't need to be chippy. And I was like, do you know what? I actually agree with that, actually, and you're right. Do you know what I mean? But that's not going to happen because privilege is so out of control in this realm right now, and particularly in our country, that unless there is a counter, then you just, like, the tide makes you a narcissist. The tide makes you self-serving. The tide, it's just the way society is right now. Mm-hmm. And unless you have that kind of, you put something in the ground, you are inevitably going to be that kind of that person. Me and my wife were talking. I was like, the moment he is cognitive and he's like, meh, he's in the car, we're driving to Leicester, I'm gonna paint at my flat and go, see that? When daddy was your age, he lived there. Any questions? So between those two camps of don't make it chippy, and actually it's your responsibility in this position to be extra chippy, actually, because you've got the energy, the resources to do that chippiness. Somewhere between there, I'll probably find myself with him.
I'm sure. We sadly have to finish. And obviously you'll know we always finish up the show asking if you could we've been celebrating you today. If you could celebrate anyone today, who would that be?
That's going to be my dear mum. Christina Anderson Ayres, and I literally wouldn't be where I am without her and that work and that drive and that aspiration. You know, I won't go over much more about her because your listeners have been smattered with stories throughout this, but she was an incredible woman. And she, funnily enough, being a parent, you know, and here I am in my lovely yard with my wife And, you know, in a world where my mixed race child is a beautiful rainbow being, literally the opposite of what my mum grew up in when she had me. And I think of, you know, that equality, equity, and you think of what she had to do just to bloody wake up and get out of bed in a day. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And that strength and that courage. And I know that she wouldn't have had that if she was middle class. That sounds awful. And I know she wouldn't. She just, it was the grind that made her what she was and made her fight outside of that. And for me, she is literally the definition of that working class hero, that it wasn't just sit in an armchair and complain about people you've never met. Mm. It was like, no, I have two. Let me see what I can do with those two. And for me, that's kind of the essence of what we all do as working class people. And the conversation before the actual podcast, just when I was talking about building the website for you when I was younger.
Yeah.
It's what we do as working class people, isn't it? We just get on with it, we make it happen, and we do it. And I think my mum truly, truly embodied that.
Aww. Well, she's left an incredible legacy with you, and she sounds like such an amazing woman.
She was, she's brilliant.
And just tell us her full name again.
Christina Anderson Ayres.
Well, we're celebrating her as well as you today, Fraser. Thank you so much. You're honestly such a huge inspiration. I'm so glad we finally got you on here to chat. But we're so up for part two, aren't we, Han?
Brilliant. Yeah, I'm totally up for that.
Do you know what? You've given me a good, I mean this as the biggest compliment I could give you. You give me a really good injection of chippiness and sometimes rattling around in, I'm in the arty bit of the industry and rattling around as a big, like, loud, earring wearing Southeast London woman. It's sometimes I need to, like, you know, plug back into my chippy working class mates.
Yeah.
It's just what I needed. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
I mean, what an incredible man. I mean, so inspiring, and his mum's story as well. It really got me, like,
do you know what? He sort of epitomises, like, what we always wanted the podcast to be about. Because you remember that thing when you once said to me, I don't know if you remember this, when we were talking about doing the podcast, you said, oh, like, whenever you mention an estate to anyone, everyone just thinks of Shameless. Like, that's what everyone thinks. But then when he was talking, obviously, you know, our listeners can hear the passion in his voice, but just looking at his face and how it lit up talking about his flat on his estate in Leicester and his mum and the way he spoke about them as a team. And he's literally just radiates joy when he talks about it. And it's just such a sort of absolutely epitomises what we always hoped the podcast would be, which was like a true celebration of what
a background. And hope, because he feels, it just made me feel really hopeful. And like
I
you
know,
said,
and,
like,
yeah.
With a real sense of, I'm going to go back out there and I'm going to send that email today and I'm going to be chippy, but I'm going to be hopeful.
Exactly. Chippy and hopeful. I might have that. Maybe we should get that made as T-shirts. Chippy but hopeful. I love that.
Listeners, if anyone's up for that, anyone wants to design us a hoodie, T-shirt, mug, chippy but hopeful, we'll go with that.
That's our motto for the week.
Oh, well, that's it for this week, guys. What an amazing guest. So inspiring. And maybe you'll go into the rest of your week being chippy and hopeful too. We'll be back next week for more, Hannah. Do you know what's this weekend, Hannah?
Oh, no, I'm busy this weekend.
It's my hen do, folks.
Woo-hoo!
Oh, we're off to Brighton.
Watch out, Brighton. The nanas are in town.
We'll see you next week, probably with a much heavier head, and hopefully I won't be tied or lost in Brighton, tied to a lamppost somewhere.
Have to wait and see.
Have a great week, guys, and remember, keep it classy.
The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangabee Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music.
Please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at The Proper Class Podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.